our Creator, who invites us to see with the vision of children of light. It's an honor and a joy to be here with you this morning. God willing, the first of many such mornings. I'll ask you a question. How many of you gave up something for Lent? So let me see a show of hands. A couple. How many of you tried to give up something for Lent and didn't succeed? A few more hands, including Pastor Bridget. And finally, how many of you thought about maybe trying to possibly give up something for Lent? There we go. I'm with you in that last camp. I've never been very good at Lenten discipline, or as the fancy theological word for it goes, ascetic practices, like fasting. It's not that I don't see their value. I'm writing the biography of a Turkish Muslim imam by the name of Fethullah Gülen. He's been in the news a lot lately. And from studying him and his life, I've learned how valuable these practices can be. As you know, during the month of Ramadan, Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset for an entire month. So I get it. For some people, there is really real value in practices like Lenten disciplines. But I don't think fasting or giving something up is really what Lent is all about. Instead, I think Lent is about clarifying our covenant. As our first reading for today put it, God has written a law, which is what a covenant was in the ancient world. He's written a law in our heart. Lent is our season to clarify that covenant, to ask ourselves, how is it going? Lent is our season to examine, to study the state of our heart, the state of our relationship with God, deep in our conscience, in our souls. Among the indigenous peoples of the world, Menominee, Oneida, Lakota, Igbo, and Yoruba, many others, there was a formalized way to study the state of one's souls and one's relationship with the spiritual world. They called it a vision quest. Sometimes this vision quest would be a rite of passage for a young man or a young woman who needed to clarify their purpose in life. But a vision quest could be undertaken by anyone whenever you needed to get greater clarity in your life. Lent is our annual vision quest. There are lots of examples of vision quests in the history of religions. The one I know best, having done it several years ago, is from the Lakota people, most of whom now live in the Dakotas and Wyoming. A Lakota vision quest starts with a sweat lodge ceremony. How many of you know what a sweat lodge is? Okay, good number of hands. So yeah, sweat lodge is like a sauna or a steam bath, only much, much hotter. Small hut, think like an ice shanty, a round ice shanty. It's constructed out of bent willow branches or some kind of tree branches, and then over which skins are placed. Sometimes nowadays tarps and blankets are used instead, but to keep it airtight. Just beside this, there's an entry point into the lodge then that has a flap over it. And just next to this, there's a huge fire blazing with stones in the fire. People go into the hut, sit down, kneel down, whatever, in a circle. And then the gatekeeper will take stones one by one from the fire into the center of the sweat lodge. The stones are called grandfathers and grandmothers because they're ancient, right? And then the stones are set in the sweat lodge, and some sweet grass and some water will be sprinkled down at the flaps closed, and it gets hot, and you sweat. Songs are sung, prayers are offered, more sweet grass is put on the stones, water, and you sweat. When I finally crawled out of the sweat lodge after maybe a half an hour of prayers, I literally could not stand up. I was drained. It was a near-death experience, almost. And then after the sweat lodge, the vision quest proper among the Lakota begins. After having been purified in a sweat lodge, a person on a vision quest goes to a remote place, usually up on a mountain, where they would sit for days at a time with no food, no drink, no guests, other than those that nature sends your way. In a very short time, after having your body drained of vital fluids in the sweat lodge, you begin to notice things differently up there on the mountain. Sounds seem sharper. Any movement grabs your attention. The breeze or rain or sun caresses your skin. You begin to see with the eyes of your heart. And you discover what the ancestors from the spiritual world want for you. You clarify your covenant. Lent is our annual vision quest. I'll get back to that point and eventually to our gospel in due course. But to do so, I'll tell you what I learned on my vision quest. Today is, after all, your introduction to me. So I hope it's all right if I share with you a story from my life. My vision quest was a little unorthodox, and it's a story I first told in my book, Shopping Malls and Other Sacred Spaces. I know, it was a fun book to write. It happened when I was in South Dakota, the land of the Lakota, to celebrate my godson, Rich Krueger's graduation from high school. And on the Saturday of that celebration, it was a glorious, sunny June morning, I sat on the Kruger front porch in the foothills of the Black Hills with my dad, Fred, and my uncle Guy, and soaked up some rays. I was reading a book by the historian of religions, Mircea Eliade, about sacred space. And after a couple hours of sitting there and reading and soaking up sun, I decided to take a hike in the foothills of the Black Hills. So I took off across the gravel road in front of the Kruger house in my sneakers and shorts, no shirt, just to take a walk in the woods. My Uncle Guy pulled out of his driveway as I was walking across the road. He was heading to the church to pick up some chairs, and he said to me, "John, don't you want to get some boots on? There's rattlesnakes out there, you know?" I shrugged, said, "Yeah, I'll be okay," and then walked very gingerly through the meadow behind their neighbor's house until I got to what looked like a trail winding around the base of the hill, and that's where I went. There was a trail there, and I took it, walked along the base of the hill for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, my body breathing deeply, smelling the sap from the pine trees that filled the air. It was glorious. And then I saw a dry gully, a washout of some kind, coming down the side of the hill, and I decided to climb up that. So I did, another 15, 20 minutes or so, and I was near the top of the hill. And I saw over to my right, near where a bunch of trees had been blown down in a tornado or some kind of a downburst, that there was this rock outcropping in the sun. And so that's where I decided to go. No trail getting there. So I crawled my way through these trees that were down and everything else, climbing over them until I got to this outcropping, this rock outcropping. And I was surprised to discover that over the rock outcropping, about 300 feet of empty air below me. It was beautiful. So I sat down, my feet dangling over the edge of this rock outcropping. I learned later that it was called Stage Barn Canyon that was below me because there used to be a stage barn down at the bottom of this canyon. So I sat there in my tennis shoes, no shirt, skin red from the sun and exercise, with my feet dangling out over 300 feet of empty air below me. It was beautiful. And then I saw the bird coming across the canyon. Recall, I'd just been reading about sacred space, and I knew that a visitation from the winged ones was a particularly auspicious, particularly cool thing, because birds represent vividly the spiritual world and their freedom. They were like the angels with their wings. And so I paid close attention to this bird as it came closer to me. It was big, with a wingspan larger than my own. And it soared beautifully, dipping and diving and turning with such grace that I couldn't help but be awed. And then there was another bird coming too, and another, and two more. All told, soon there were five huge birds in the blue sky over Stage Barn Canyon, circling and soaring right above me. I was transfixed with awe. I had never seen anything like this before, having grown up in Appleton, Wisconsin. And then I noticed the lead bird was coming closer, much closer. I could see the individual feathers on his wings. I could see her eyes, beady, hungry. I could see the beak hooked for tearing flesh with a bright pink tongue. And I could see those talons, pointed and sharp, extended, reaching for me. And I thought, I'm lunch. But I couldn't speak. I felt paralyzed. All I could manage to do was to clap my hands. The lead bird vaulted up, and then just as quickly, whew, flew back down. It was maybe 15 feet away from me. I couldn't move. I clapped my hands one more time, and then without waiting to see what the bird did, managed to figure out, okay, I got to move. So I did a backward somersault off this rock, completely forgetting now about rattlesnakes, right? Double roll, lean up against a birch tree, leaves in my hair, heart beating like this. As I did that, the lead bird took off across the canyon, and then one by one, the other birds also left. I had never before felt hunted. Almost immediately, I left that place. I hurried back down the mountain as quickly as I could, almost running to get back to my Aunt Joni and Uncle Guy's home. There were some big birds up there on the mountain, I told Guy, no doubt fear still oozing through my voice. Probably turkey vultures, he said. Hello, maybe eagles. Did they have white heads? No, they didn't, I recalled. Vultures, then, Guy said. Gradually, my heart started slowing down, and I returned to something approaching normal. But what I've learned from this unorthodox vision quest has stayed with me for the rest of my life. I'll come back to that, too. In our gospel for today, Jesus offers us one of the somewhat rambling discourses that the Gospel of John is famous for. There's a lot going on in this passage. But at its heart, is this idea. When we face fragility honestly, we live. When we cling to life, we die. Albert Schweitzer, the great Lutheran musician, theologian, doctor, Nobel Peace Prize winner, put it like this. The real tragedy of life is what dies inside a person while still living. The real tragedy of life is what dies inside a person while still living. God wants us to live, and so God's covenant in our heart is really pretty simple when we get down to it. Love God and love our neighbors. When we do this, we do what Jesus did. Like Jesus, when we love, we get lifted up. In love, we find the flow that is true living. Hell, Fyodor Dostoevsky said, is the suffering of being unable to love. So love, being in love, must be a lot like what heaven is like. Heaven is like that flow that warms us whenever we're loving. But how often, like Jesus in our passage for today, do we, instead of acting from love, get caught up in fears or anxieties of one kind or another? Our hearts get troubled. Maybe we're worried about school. Maybe we're worried about a health matter. Maybe we're worried about finances. Maybe we're worried about a relationship that's gone wrong. Maybe we're worried about whether we'll get a job or not. Sorry, couldn't resist. It doesn't matter the source of that worry. But when darkness clouds our vision, it's good to be reminded that Jesus, the incarnate God, worried too. His soul could be troubled. And yet he knew, he taught, that very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. This is the heart of every vision quest, in Lent or among the Lakota, to face death, to face our fragility honestly and without fear. When we do, we live in the light, because it is the fear of death that is at the root of all other fears. And if death has lost its sting, then of what can we possibly be afraid? Listen, I tell you a mystery. Apostle Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 15. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? This is to walk in the light, to be a child of light along with Jesus. Whatever our worries, Jesus knows them. Whatever troubles our souls, we can face them together. Whatever our sins and weaknesses, God knows them. Whatever our potential, God can help us to realize it. Lent is our annual vision quest. So how is yours going? What is your new vision? What is our collective vision of living and working together in love here in Green Bay, in America, around the world? As for my first big vision quest, my encounter with five vultures at Stage Barn Canyon, here's what I learned. I wasn't in control. I was so out of place, so naive, that my immediate reaction to this strange encounter was terror, fear of death. Each time I retell the story, though, I learn from it, not least about the habits and existence of turkey vultures, which, according to one interpreter, is a more accurate interpretation of the Hebrew word nesher, used for God in Deuteronomy 32, than the more frequent translation, eagle. You know the song. We're going to sing it soon. And God will raise you up on vulture's wings, bear you on the breath of dawn, you know, etc. It doesn't lose anything in that translation, as I see it. For the more I've gotten to know about vultures and their habits, and I've kind of taken to studying them since my encounter, I can see them clearly enough as signs of God's presence and a source of spiritual truth. For these huge birds with wingspans of up to 6 feet are sociable, friendly birds, according to the Turkey Vulture Society. And no, I did not make that up. The Turkey Vulture Society's members study the birds and seek to preserve their habitats. Turkey vultures are omnivores who primarily eat plants, for they cannot always find a good carcass to clean up. They live in families or roosts, often in the same place for over a century, usually, guess what, rock ledges or cliffs. In short, I was in their place, probably the first person to visit in decades and quite possibly ever, given that no trail ascended to the spot. They were curious. Others observers have noted that the birds like people. In captivity, a turkey vulture will play with its caretaker, bouncing a ball back and forth with its head, following the caretaker around and watching his or her motions, even playing tug-of-war with an object like a pet dog. Seriously, they are called the peace eagle by the Cherokee because they so rarely hunt. Still, my experience with turkey vultures certainly brought me in touch with my fragility. I learned that I live in the same world with them, and I wasn't sure I trusted them. I knew they were huge and that I was in an unfamiliar and strange place, quite possibly their roost or even a nest where a mating pair might have left a couple eggs. Who knows? I learned what it felt like to be hunted. I learned fear. Now, I suppose that if my experience had been part of a formal vision quest, my name might be John, Afraid of Vultures, Paul. I kind of like it. It's who I was. But I'm not afraid of them anymore. I saw firsthand not only the awesome nature of these birds, but also their freedom, their beauty, their stunning ability to soar. The Turkey Vulture Society calls them the most graceful soaring birds in the world, and I would have to agree. They hold their wings all but silent in a V shape without flapping, just feeling the air current and making adjustments with their wingtips to soar for hours on end. They communicate with other birds to know where their food might be, and they enjoy playing in the games in the air, like follow the leader, tag, and speed soaring. I do think of them as angels. Maybe that's too strong, but I know I learned from them, and that someday, like them, I will be lifted up when I die. For vultures live in proximity to death, like Jesus did. He knew what was coming to him. Vultures like Jesus face death honestly and even manage to thrive from it. The Mayans thus called vultures death eaters. I think that's profound. For Christians, we might put it this way. Jesus is our death eater. After Jesus, love is stronger than death. So here's the point, and then I'm done. We can welcome the vultures in our life. I think it's still good I rolled off the rock. But we can welcome the vultures in our life. Greet them. Don't be afraid of them. For very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But when it dies, it bears much fruit. This is true, as any of you who are farmers or gardeners surely know. This is true as we learn from those young people who face the death of school shootings honestly and walk out to lead us toward greater justice and peace. And so, may the remainder of our Lenten vision quest be fruitful. May the covenant written in our hearts be renewed, clarified, and strengthened. May each of us walk in the light as children of light, and may Easter, our feast of the resurrection, our feast of love, after the long fast of this season, may our Easter be filled with new joy and hope. And all God's people say, Amen.